Thank you very much. Absolute pleasure to be here. We all know why we're here. We're here to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the birth of Ada Lovelace. And in 1843, Ada Lovelace published a paper called Sketch of the Analytical Engine, which described a vast mechanical calculating engine designed by the mathematician and lifelong friend of Ada called Charles Babbage. And any claim to fame that Ada has as a pioneer of the history in the history of computing is based on the contents of this particular paper, this sketch. It was her only substantial publication. She died 9 years later, in 1852, at the age of 36. So everything we wish to say, and that is not about the huge variety of her other interests, everything we need to say about her as having a role or a place in the history of computing is based on this specific and single publication. And that's what we will be hearing a great deal about in some of the coming sessions. So what I propose to do is something very specific. What I propose to do is tell you enough about the analytical engine for us to make a judgment about the nature and value of what Lovelace did. So it's quite narrow. I will not be dealing with whether Lovelace's relationship to drugs was entirely medicinal. I will not be dealing with whether her gambling addiction was an altruistic attempt to restore the family fortunes by recovering some of the huge amounts of money her husband, William King, had expended on his bizarre and vast building projects. So, some of the things I will not be dealing with in my narrow compass of dealing only with the analytical engine is the various things that have stories, narratives that have abounded by her. Her related to drugs, the question of whether her attempts to gamble were actually quite altruistic to restore the family fortunes, to recover monies that her husband had expended on these vast building construction projects on his many estates. Whether her mother, Annabella Milbank, was an enlightened educationalist or whether she was in fact a vindictive disciplinarian. And finally, the construction of her reputation in the modern age. There's a feast of papers to follow. There's going to address these many dimensions of Lovelace's life. So what I'm concerned specifically with here this morning is, what was it about Babbage's machine that so seized Lovelace's imagination? And what was it that she said about it that is supposedly so remarkable? So it's quite a narrow compass. And now, Babbage met Lovelace in June 1833 at a society do. This image on the left is taken from a portrait that was done for her coming out party. As a member of the aristocracy, she was entitled to be presented at court, and that which was on the 10th of May, and this portrait dates from within 3 weeks of her meeting Babbage. Babbage is slightly older. Lovelace was 17, Babbage was 42 at this particular meeting. And Lady Byron wrote that Ada was delighted with Babbage, he was full of animation, and talked about his wonderful machine. 12 days later, that's on the 17th of June, Lady Byron and Ada Byron visited Babbage at his house in Dorset Street and had a demonstration of what was built on his first difference engine. And this was Lovelace's first exposure to any both to Babbage and his concept of his engines. At the time they met, Babbage was a prominent and controversial figure in scientific life. He was well known for his for several mathematical publications, 13 in fact, before he was 30. He was ambivalently famous for the invention of his machine, which he had failed to build at massive government expense. He was capable of great charm and also of brazen rudeness. He felt somehow that being right entitled him to be rude. He was fiercely principled. His enemies could do no right and his friends could do no wrong. He was capable of incontinent savagery in his attacks on the scientific establishment about what he alleged to be their poor superintendence of science. He was, in fact, the enfant terrible of science well into adulthood. So we have a complex and imposing figure. Ada was keen to meet him. She was keen to make a mark in the world of ideas and to be exposed to cultural and intellectual protagonists. And Babbage was certainly a big figure and encouraged by her mother to meet. So the question is, back to our narrow program, what was it that Lovelace saw on that day in which Babbage demonstrated, amongst other things, his theory of miracles? And what does the engine do? How does it work, and how did it come to be? Now, we're going to spend a bit of time on Difference Engine 1 because the central ideas about the core ideas in computing, recognizable in modern computing, were actually developed as a result of Babbage's speculations on Difference Engine 1 in virtue of being an automaton, in virtue of it being automatic. And we will spend briefly some time on this. It also helped to understand what is involved in the implementation of mechanical logic, of which there are several examples outside by projects that are ongoing now, to see how else might Babbage have done that had he not done it in the way he did. So how did it all come to be? What were Babbage's aspirations? What were his expectations? Why was he doing this at all? The Genesis episode is captured in a well-known vignette of spring 1821. Babbage and Herschel are sitting and checking the accuracy of mathematical astronomical tables that had been calculated by hand. Increasingly, errors become evident. Babbage becomes increasingly agitated by these errors, and he, as it were, clasps his hand to his head and he says, "I wish to God these calculations had been executed by steam." Steam being a metaphor both for the infallibility of machinery and as a metaphor for industrial production. The idea is that machines would be a factory of numbers, and his son actually says, "The machine be a manufactory of numbers." So we have number as industrial product. It's the extension of the industrial metaphor from the production of goods to the production of, if you like, mental products. The transition from matter to mind, from thing to thought, if you like. So that's the genesis of it. So Babbage became completely enraptured in this idea, became ill with the intensity with which he worked, and he immediately sat down and started devising how he might do this, and rushed down to Herschel in Slough a few weeks later with some manuscripts, which we are going to see for the first time today. So the engine that Babbage first designed was Difference Engine Number 1, so called because of the mathematical principle on which it's based, which is the method of finite differences. This is the piece that Lovelace saw. It is 1/7 of the full-sized engine. It is full-scale, but it is 1/7 of the full engine, and that's all that was built in Babbage's lifetime. In fact, it's the most substantial artifact of half a century of effort, of design and development effort, that Babbage undertook. So how does it work? Well, number values are represented by the rotation, the angular rotation of figure wheels. So we can see that these are column of figure wheels. The number wheels are represented by the angular rotation. A multi-digit number is represented by a column of wheels that we can see on the right here, with units at the bottom, tens above, hundreds, and so on. So if you want to represent 2.5, you do not take a wheel and put it between 2 and 3. You have a wheel which has a 2 on it and a wheel which has a 3 on it, and they sit as a stack. So this is digital. Only whole numbers are legitimate and determinate values. Now we know that wheels are not digital devices. All the intermediate values are viable and stable. So the machine would be infallible, not in virtue of being mechanical. It would be infallible because Babbage could make control mechanisms that would enforce digital operations. So the idea, how he dealt with the issue of certainty, was to ensure digital operations through the control mechanisms. And this is what occupied a great deal of Babbage's efforts, to ensure that the integrity of the calculation could not be compromised. And we're going to look at a mechanism by which he manages to do that. This is a mechanism of Difference Engine 1. And we can see there a sprung lever. This is a lever with a spring there, which biases the lever into the space between the lobes. So you can see that as this wheel turns, the sprung lever biases it so that it favors resting in the position that is an integral whole number. Now, the lever performs three functions. It performs error prevention, error correction, and error detection. So, error prevention, if the wheel is slightly deranged, the roller will slightly, we can look at that slightly more closely, the roller will push in between the lobes and center it. If the lever is locked, it will prevent the wheel deranging during periods in which it's not supposed to move. And if the wheel is on the cusp, the top of the lobe, it indicates that this wheel is in an indeterminate position. The integrity of the calculation has been compromised. Stop the machine. Jam the machine. So jamming is not the catastrophe you would think it is. The machines have a subsequent wind. Jam, they are designed to jam. Jamming is a form of error correction. It's an alert that the integrity of their calculation has been compromised. So these are digital wheels. It's evident, it's clearly here, that this is an attempt to digitize and discretize mechanical motion to ensure the integrity and accuracy of the results. That's how I dealt with the issue of reliability. Now, this was not the result of a failed series of trials going digital. It was evident in the very earliest conception of the machine, because we have what we believe are the very first scribblings after Babbage's mechanical epiphany in spring 1821, where he wrote down what he might do, and he rushes down to Herschel to go and explain what his ideas were. And we believe, and these manuscripts are in the Museum of the History of Science in Oxford. You can see immediately, this is the very earliest document. Babbage himself thought it dated from 1820. We know it dates from about 1821. You can see immediately that there are lobes on these wheels. There's a ratchet. He talks about click wheels and ratchets. There's the sprung lever. And if we look at the next one, we can see the steel roller, the leaf spring, and the lobes. This was embedded in the very earliest conception that the machine was going to be digital. That's how he dealt with uncertainty. What does the machine do? The way the machine works is you enter initial values that you calculate by hand onto these wheels by hand. You then crank the handle at the top of the top plate, which is here, and the machine adds a number on that column, according to the method of finite difference, which you needn't go into. But what it allows you to do is calculate a class of mathematical expressions called polynomials by repeated addition only, and eliminates the need for multiplication and division, which ordinarily would be needed to do such calculations. So that's the value of the principle. And what the machine does is repeated addition by cranking the handle. This is probably the most celebrated icon in the prehistory of computing. It is the first machine to successfully incorporate mathematical rule in mechanism. You crank the handle and exert physical energy, and you can get results which up to that point in time could only be achieved by mental effort. The idea that the machine was thinking was not lost on Babbage or his contemporaries. Lady Byron, who with Ada visited the machine, wrote in her diary, "Last week we saw the thinking machine, for such it seems." Harry Wilmot Buxton, a junior colleague of Babbage's, wrote, "The marvelous pulp and fiber of the brain had been replaced by brass and iron. He, Babbage, had taught wheelwork to think, or to do the office of thought." So we see the extension of the industrial metaphor for ideas of mental product. What were Babbage's expectations of this engine? What did he think they were for? And Babbage was 28 when he first conceived of this engine, and up to that point his intellectual life had been dominated entirely by mathematics. From school, he did a tripos at Cambridge and then came up to London, and by the age of 29 he had published 13 mathematical papers. He was a man steeped in mathematics, which he confessed subsequently was his first love. So we have a mathematician, for the first time, with an automatic machine, a machine capable of autonomy, speculating what the implications and potential for machine computation was. And between June and December 1822, he wrote 6 papers. And none of them have to do with errors in tables. They are all to do with mathematical potential. And what he writes is quite remarkable. What he says is the machine can solve equations. And I don't know if there's time, but let's very briefly say how to solve equations. The way you solve an equation in the analytic school is you equate the root of an equation is the value of the independent variable that reduces the expression to zero. Now, if the machine is producing a result on the last, column, say, each time you crank the handle, it produces the next value of the expression, you have found a root when the all zero state appears on the last. If the result is zero, then the number of times you've cranked the handle is the value of the independent variable. So he suddenly sees the idea of computation as systematic method for the first time. And he was the first person to be in the position to actually speculate on these grounds. So the machine can solve equations. It can find the value of a series for which there's no general expression of the nth term. You crank through, you find the value. You don't need to know how to calculate that analytically. There was heuristic value. You could set the machine up to do various things for which there was no analytic expression. So there were new series you could produce because you had a generative rule that was mechanical but not analytical. He saw that there'd be a need for a branch which we now call numeric analysis, of analyzing problems to optimize them for machine computation. So he used an example of what he writes a mathematical expression and say in that form you need 35 multiplications in one division, and you can manipulate that to produce a mathematically identical expression and use 5 multiplications in one addition, for example, is a kind of example he gave. So you would manipulate things for the to optimize it for machine computation. And he predicts that without machine computation, science would stultify through what he calls the overwhelming encumbrance of numerical detail. So he sees the potential reliance of science on machine computation for its own survival. So at the time Ada Lovelace comes into the scene, enters the scene in 1833, in June 1833, Babbage had been working on his machines for 12 years. He was an accomplished and published mathematician, and he had an opportunity to, in these very early days, 1822 onwards, to speculate about the implications and potential of machine computation. Babbage, as we know, never completed any of his machines, but there is an epilogue. There is a machine that was completed to original designs, which is different engine number 2, designed 1847. I was had the good fortune to be responsible for the construction of this machine, and I mentioned that there is an epilogue. This is a machine that weighs 5 tons. It has 8,000 parts. It works exactly as Babbage describes. It took 17 years to build, and it's at the Science Museum and can be demonstrated. If anyone is interested, I have a 4-minute video of it, of the thing operating. It is quite a sumptuous spectacle to see. It's a kind of mechanical choreography, a ballet of mechanical extraordinariness. And since the title of this lecture is Visions of Computing, if you're talking about a literal vision, it is difficult to see how one would not, if one was a Victorian, contemplating such a machine, be inspired by the potential of what these things, these machines might do. Babbage invented, I'm not going to spend much time because Adrian Johnston is going to be speaking about a project which touches on all this. Babbage devised a symbolic language called the mechanical notation. He was inordinately proud of it. Its fate was that of spectacular obscurity. The point is, there is no comprehensive grammar book, there is no complete lexicon, and nobody speaks the language. And if you think of the engine as a text, and you think of the notation as a text, which are expressions of a unifying idea, we can use our intimate knowledge of the engine to decode the notation, which is what we've done, and Adrian will be talking about that project. I was saying about sumptuous spectacle, that's the back of the engine, and this is the kind of notation. It looks like mathematics, it is not a calculus, it is a descriptive notation, and that's what we can now read as a result of having built the engine without reference to the notation. So that's just a trailer for a later presentation. The analytical engine. This is what Ada described. This is Plan 28, 1840, which is more or less the state of the engine at the time Ada entered the scene in a very intensive way when she started studying mathematics again, returning to mathematics having had having got married and had 3 children. And this would be roughly the state of the engine at which that Ada had in her mind when she was describing the machine and writing her notes. And we'll just briefly look at some of the features of it. It's the best known of the drawings because Babbage actually, there are very few drawings that give an overview of the entire system. So if we just look at some of its features, this huge central area is the mill, which we would now call a central processor. The linear area on the right is called the store, which we would call memory now. The physical scale of this is absolutely astronomical. Well, not literally, but figuratively. This is about 6 foot across in diameter, the mill. It's about 15 foot high. There are 17, the store here, if we look at each of these, so this is the plan, it's looking down on the machine. So each of these circles is a column of figure wheels. So V1, V2, these are variables, called variables, are columns of figure wheels in the store, in the memory. So each of these things is a column, and we need to know that, and I'm going to ask you just to remember this brief configuration here of the memory, because we're going to map this onto Ada's Bernoulli program. So there's the mill, which is the central processor. There's a separation of the mill and the store, which is a feature of von Neumann architecture described in 1945, and which has dominated computer design to the present day. That feature is present and inherent in this design. The machine was had enormous capability. It had an internal repertoire of automatic instructions, so it could do automatic division, multiplication, subtraction, addition automatically. You gave it a macro instruction, it did it through internal manipulation. The store is truncated here for a method for reasons of drafting convenience. There are 17 registers, V things, shown here, a bunch up top and a bunch at the bottom, but it's truncated. The machine with 17 variables would be 18 foot long. Babbage spoke of an entry-level machine with 100 variables, which would be 45 foot long, And he spoke of machines with 1,000 variables. You're talking about something extending roughly the width of this theater. And so when we talk about a quantum leap in logical conception and physical scale, we mean this absolutely literally. The machine, one of its revolutionary features, was that it could be programmed using punch cards. And these are an example of punch cards. Those cards solve a simultaneous equations, first order simultaneous equations. The cards on the right are operation cards that tell you what arithmetical operation to perform. The cards on the left are variable cards which tell you where in the memory to find the operand. Where is what you need to operate on to be found, and where should you put the results? There are other kinds of cards, but those are the main kinds of cards. And this is one of Babbage's card readers. You can see here, it's draped over a prism. They are fan-folded, stitched together with ribbon, pasteboard cards. The pool of cards is there. And as this prism approaches these levers, if there is a hole, the lever goes through and takes no action. If there is no hole, the lever is activated. And so that is how the communication between punch cards and the machine works, by interrogating whether there is or is not a hole in a series of cards. And there's many, many of these card readers distributed around the machine to read the various pieces of cards. And I'm hoping that Sydney Padua in tomorrow's session will show us some renderings of the engine, of the complete engine, how it looks like in 3D, using of which some of these these machines are present. So, we know from Babbage that the notion of punch cards came to the Jacquard loom. Jacquard loom is a way of producing complex fabrics where the pattern of the fabric is contained in the card. Now, Lovelace writes, and this is a well-known quote of hers, we may say most aptly that the analytical engine weaves algebraic patterns, just as the Jacquard loom weaves flowers and leaves. Now, this is usually taken as some poetical flourish. But there is an absolutely fundamental idea, which is not usually associated with the Jacquard loom, that I believe Lovelace, as we shall see later, absolutely grasps. There's the notion of universality and of specificity of function, even if I can pronounce that correctly. The idea is the machine, the loom can make any pattern. What specific pattern it produces is in the software, is in the cards. And Lovelace understands that there is the notion of a universal machine and specificity of function, which is contained in software, in programs. And that we will see how that unrolls and unravels and is folded into the concept of the analytical engine. So when she says the analytical engine weaves algebraic patterns, just she's talking about a generalized algebra machine that can do any form of mathematics, provided the machine can be programmed to do so. So this poetic flourish it is, but I believe actually embodies a substantially more profound idea. The machine can do automatic microprogramming. This is one of the barrels. I won't go into that, but basically, the machine has a fetch-execute cycle, and if you say, print this, fetch that, do that, whatever it does it automatically. And it does it using barrels, which are, if you like, internal words, which are these things. There can be 50 to 100 of these verticals. There are studs in these verticals, and as this barrel moves forward, it either activates or does not activate these levers, depending or not whether the stud is present. Now, for instance, whether this stud is present will produce a conditional branch. If the stud is present, when that barrel advances, it will not activate lever C. If the stud is present, because that lever is flopped into place, then it will activate that, and that is a condition that has been met. If a condition is met, insert that slug, so when the barrel advances, it activates the lever. If the slug is not inserted, it takes no action at all. And because this thing is on a fixed cycle, that condition can occur, so it can cater for pre-existing conditionals. It can do multi-way branches. There are other branching mechanisms which are down here in this reducing apparatus. And each time it goes back and forwards, the barrel turns into its next word to execute the next word. And what that next word is depends on conditionals and the previous word. So you can see it's complex. It's inherent. That is how it performs its internal automatic operations. Now, Babbage was sufficiently advanced with the design of the analytical forums to start programming in 1837. And between 1837 and 1840, he wrote 24 programs, which include various examples of which are the solution of multiple simultaneous equations up the third order. He also has recursion, or what he calls recurrence relationships, which require a repeated sequence of operations, because the machine can actually iterate. It can back off a sequence of operation cards and back them forward again. So it can repeat the same sequence of operations multiple times. It's capable of iteration. And so he has recursion, three recursion examples in which each next result requires the previous result and a repetition of the same set of calculations. So this is 1837, and we're going to look at some of his programs now. That's all he ever built. It's an experimental model under construction at the time of his death in 1871. This is one of Babbage's earliest programs, August 1837, we're talking about here. And it's to solve two simultaneous equations, first order simultaneous equations. So you need to solve for x and solve for y and eliminate your two variables by substitution and so on. So his first program looks like that. This is his program, and we're going to look at briefly at the format. So we'll just expand that ringed area, which is that. So let's look at some of these features, and this will help us when we get to Ada Lovelace's famous Bernoulli example. So firstly, we have line numbers. Anyone who used a line editor in the old days will recognize that. You then have what operation is... Yes, there are people who know line editors. then there's what next operation is performed. So there are four multiplications performed in order, followed by subtraction, a subtraction, a division. Right. The next column tells you what variables, what is being acted on. And there's our reminders up here. And there we can see V1, V2, V3. I'll ask you to remember the format of that, the memory, with its Vs, with its vertical columns of figures. These are the contents of the various variables. And the table here tells you what's being operated and where it's being placed in store. And just to show you how that maps onto the thing, that was the original diagram. And you can see that V, the variables, those are the stores. We now call them perhaps registers. Registers in the store are mapped onto each of these columns, which tell you what is the contents at each and any stage. So we have essential features of a program here, which are, it specifies each step of the operation. It tells you what operation is performed, on what it is it performs, and where the results are placed. And that is what this diagram does. Now, in what sense is this a program? Now, neither Babbage nor Lovelace used that term, nor do they use words like algorithm. So, if we look at a very convenient, readily understandable definition of what a program is by Tom Hagen, Mark Priestley, who said that a program is a single series of instructions that could be fed into a general-purpose computer to automatically control its operation. Very simple. This is clearly not a program. It is a series of arithmetical instructions. The program is in the cards. There is no control information in this program. There's no control information here. It just tells you what the series of instructions are, and it's like a state diagram. So it's more accurate to call it perhaps a trace, and that's a word that Lovelace uses, or a simulated trace, or a walkthrough, or even a state diagram to tell you what state the machine is in. But I think there are a number of features that do fit comfortably with the idea of a program, sequential operation, defined rules, and data structure. And there is primarily an algorithmic intention in what this is doing. So I don't think we'd be committing a great intellectual crime if we did continue to refer to this and Lovelace's as a program, bearing in mind that our definition of a program is an anachronistic one based on what we now understand a program to be. So finally, we get to Lovelace's sketch, the sketch of the analytical engine. Firstly, there's one thing we need to do before that. Babbage disdained to lecture. He was heckled once when he lectured. He was, as a young man, was cripplingly shy. And for whatever reason, he never lectured in England. The only time he ever lectured on his analytical engine was in 1840, when he was invited by Giovanni Plana to attend a convention in Turin. And there he expounded on his analytical engine. Present was Luigi Menabrea, an Italian engineer, subsequently Prime Minister of Italy, who then wrote an article in French, published in 1842, of a description. And included in Menabrea's paper are two programs. And they are exactly the examples from Babbage's 1832. That's Menabrea's article translated into English by Lovelace. And there are tiny alterations. But that's effectively the format of Menabrea's program, which is taken directly. It's the same example of solving two linear simultaneous equations from Babbage's 1837 thing. So Babbage went to Turin, explained the thing, used these as examples, and this is embodied in the first publication, which Lovelace, as we shall see, subsequently translated.
So we come finally to what did Ada do? Let's get the time frame straight. Lovelace was born 1815. She married William King, 1835. She was then Ada Byron, then she became Ada Augusta King. And in 1838, William King was elevated to an earldom, and so Ada Byron, Ada King, became Ada Countess of Lovelace. That is the account for the multiple names by which she's known by. And the period we're talking about is the period in which she wrote the notes, which is 1843. 6 months between February and August, there was the starburst of activity, where Lovelace and Babbage were involved in a frenetic collaboration involving sometimes three or four exchanges per day in addition to visits, during which Ada wrote the notes. So Ada translated Menabrea's article, possibly on the suggestion of Wheatstone, without Babbage's knowledge. Babbage is presented with his fait accompli, and he says, "Why didn't you write an article of your own?" And she said, "It never occurred to her." And he said, "Add the notes." And that is how Ada's famous sketch came to be. So we're talking about that six-month period of extraordinary collaboration. During that period, their relationship is very interesting. She becomes bossy, coquettish. She's self-exalting about the excellence of her own work. She gives him stern instructions. She badgers him for explanations. And she threatens him with her annoyance if he does not comply, and if he mixes up her drafts and makes gratuitous alterations. It was a very friendly, productive collaboration. And there was no ill intent in it at all, except for one spat, which had nothing to do actually with the content of the material. So Sketch was published in August 1843 in Taylor's Scientific Memoirs, and Lovelace was 26 years old at the time. Babbage, as we said, was 42 when Lovelace was 17. Babbage was 1 year older than Ada's mother. And finally, the famous paper, Scientific Memoirs. It was a journal which specialized in bringing to English-speaking readers foreign scientific papers. And Wheatstone actually sat on the committee that was responsible, if you like, for lobbying for material, which is possibly the roots of his suggestion that Ada should do this. The title bears Menabrea's name. It does not include Lovelace's name. But each of the seven notes, notes A to G, that Lovelace included, are signed with her initials, AAL, except for the last one, which is signed ALL, which is a typo. So we can see that from the page numbering that the length of Ada's notes is twice the length of Menabrea's original paper. Babbage says it's three times, but I counted them, not the words, but the pages. The notes essentially expansions and elaborations of Menabrea's article, with two exceptions, mostly note A and note G. Note A is philosophical, which is of interest to us, and note G is the Bernoulli example, which we're now going to look at. Then we're going to return to note A, which is the philosophical side. So, and this is a Bernoulli formula. It doesn't matter if that means nothing to you, and Rainer Glaschik sitting there is responsible for that nice form of that particular equation because Lovelace does not include it. This is the formula that Lovelace derives, doesn't matter how. This is the Bernoulli expression. What she's calculating is B. Each next B in the series defined by that, for which you need all prior Bs and have to recalculate all the prior known, already calculated Bernoulli numbers, which then you then produce a weighted sum by these A's, which are the coefficients, which have to be recalculated for each Bernoulli number. So that's actually what's there. It's an ambitious calculation to do, computationally and manually. Bernoulli numbers were known from the 18th century. 5 minutes. I'm in trouble. thank you. Bernoulli numbers were known quite well. They were calculated by hand. They were published first in 1713. So we'll now look at the choice of the Bernoulli example was Lovelace's. Even though Babbage had written to von Humboldt earlier on, about using the engine to calculate Bernoulli numbers. So Babbage, Lovelace writes to Babbage and said, "I have in mind to include a Bernoulli number in one of my notes. Send me," she says, "the data and the formulae. Send me the data and formulae." It sounds like an imperious thing, but it was actually a friendly request. And the date of that letter is slightly uncertain, but it's thought to be around May. And if you go back to Babbage's scribbling books, on the 7th of May, we see he starts fiddling with Bernoulli numbers. And Babbage records that he sent this to Ada and Ada sent them back to him because they found a grave mistake. And if we look at the thing, there are two mistakes. One is the relationship of that term is ambiguous. It should be present, but it's crossed out. And the, if we go to the next slide, that coefficient is wrong. So just people were puzzling what the reference to the error was, and I know Rainer was, I believe that is the error. So let's get on with the thing, the actual problem. This is what the fuss is all about. This is Ada's program, in inverted commas still, of the Bernoulli number solution, calculating that equation. And we can see it has all the essential features of the Menabrea, which is derived, Menabrea example, which are derived from Babbage's programs from 6-7 years earlier. So let's just look more closely at that. We can see the same structure, the linear order, what you call it, where the variables are, where they are, how they're arranged in the store, and we can map that exactly as we mapped the other one, that's mapped into it, and so on. The essential information is all there. There's an index, a double index, to which is in line 2. If we just look at line 2 very briefly. This says, the contents of in register 4, subtract the contents of register 1, variable 1, from the contents of variable in register 4 and put it in variable 4. So you're overwriting one of the operands with the result. They had no notation to do this. And there's the double notation, the leading and trailing index, is a way of following what Lovelace calls an index of location, which is where it is, which is the bottom index, and an index of alteration, which is the upper index. And if we look at that, this is what they were trying to avoid. Mathematicians hated statements of that kind. It was an offense against mathematical identity. So we have a flag here that in order to code computers, you needed a new notation. There are other ways of doing it, computer assignment arrow. And they were so concerned about this that Victorians actually invented emoticons to express this. Ah. And that is the form that Ada uses, which is leading and trailing index, to show the index of location, where it is, and index of alteration, so that V4, the contents of variable 4, has been changed in the process of that calculation. And Bernard, who follows this session, if I ever finish, immediately will be elaborating on aspects of the notation. So let me wind up now. Okay, where does that magnificent notation come from? Right, we go back to Babbage's thing, and we look in this little table, and there is the double index. It's both, right, and he used Roman numerals, and not later he changed them to do. But the point is, in his earliest programs, he already saw the need for a notation, the notational need for showing index of alteration. So how do you express the fact that something had changed, and how can you track back how, through all this, what the contents of that register have been through the history, through the trajectory of the calculation. So let me get to what I'm getting at here. The seemingly dismal conclusion is that it is very difficult to identify features of Lovelace's Bernoulli example that do not have precedence in Babbage's earliest programming examples or the derivative examples in Menabrea. It is very, very difficult to find any feature of this that has not been. Now, I'd like to emphasize that the purpose of doing this is not to discredit Ada Lovelace. Ada Lovelace never made any claim to be the first programmer. She makes no claim for having any precedence, for being responsible for any precedence in the creation of programs. This is a construction. It's a confection of our modern age. And I say this is not directed at Lovelace, who is blameless in this. It is directed at people who have followed and perpetuated this particular perception. Now, as an historian, I can be offended, but I can be offended in the privacy of my own attic. There is something more important to be offended about is that to focus and to concentrate on Lovelace as the first programmer masks actually what her real contribution was, which I would argue is vastly more important than adding yet another example to Babbage's pre-existing set of programs. And I will conclude by saying what it is I think Lovelace's three contributions are. Apart from the fact it's contradicted by history, the first program thing, this is what I believe Lovelace, which is masked by this obsession with this Bernoulli program. First, the leap from calculation to computing, which is a leap that Lovelace made and nobody else did. Secondly, the recognition that computers are difference in kind from anything that had gone before. Finally, the kind of discourse that Sketch represents. So firstly, the transition from calculation to computing. It was Lovelace who articulated for the first time that number could represent entity other than quantity. She speaks that number could represent letter of the alphabet, note of music. It was she who saw that the power and potential of computers lay in the ability of a machine to manipulate representations of the world contained in symbols. She made the connection between the machine and the world. Machines can only operate on numbers. If we assign meaning to those numbers, the machine operates on the numbers, we map those meanings back, and the machine is saying something about the world. It's a very simple idea. It's very difficult to put yourself in a position to the point at which that wasn't true. But then it wasn't, and we'll see presently, or very briefly, why. So she wrote, the machine might act on other things besides number. Supposing, for instance, that the fundamental relations of pitch sounds and the science of harmony and musical composition were susceptible to such expressions and adaptations, the engine might compose elaborate scientific pieces of music and any degree of complexity and extent. So that's a well-known quote of hers. Now, was the choice of notes judicious? Because there is a quantitative relation between frequency and pitch. Is there a trick here that this is not a generalized thing? There is enough in there to show, on very close reading, that the central idea of symbolic representation of things other than number is present and can be defended. Secondly, that it's historically novel and different in kind. She wrote that the analytical engine does not occupy common ground with mere calculating machines. It holds a position wholly its own. And if we jump to Minsky, 1967, Minsky's saying of computer and computer-like machines, neither history nor philosophy nor common sense will tell us how these machines will affect us, for they do not work as did the machines of the Industrial Revolution. This is Lovelace seeing the difference between a tool with a specific function and universality of the Turing kind, almost, that she saw embodied in the Jacquard loom, which is why that poetic flourish about algebraic patterns. I'm nearly done. Finally, what kind of discourses? The moment we start reading the notes, we are lifted out of the technocentric writing of Babbage about his engines into a different conceptual discourse. We are talking about ideas. Lovelace is asking, what does this machine signify? What does it mean? And to what extent is what it signifies important? Nowhere in his published writing or any of the manuscripts that I've looked at does Babbage write in this way. Nowhere does he talk about the engine outside mathematics, being bound by number. Extraordinary in the scope and scale of his work, there is that dimension which is not there. How was Babbage influenced by Lovelace? This is the very last little bit. Babbage was much taken with her ideas, and to the extent that actually, about note A and note G specifically, and to the extent that he didn't want to actually return her drafts, he wanted to keep them. And he writes to her, said, I'm loath to send these back to you. And he wrote, Babbage writes, the more I read your notes, the more surprised I am at them and regret at not having earlier explored so rich a vein in the noblest metal. So he's saying, golly, these are marvelous things. If he was influenced at all, there is not the slightest evidence for it. Not at all. Because in 1869, 2 years before his death, he sat down, well, I assume he wrote when he was sitting, and he attempted to describe the general description of the analytical engine. And three times he's tried to, in May and December 1869, 2 years before death, he tried to convey to the world what the purpose of this engine was. And each one starts with, we can get there, the general description of the analytical engine, May 1869, and we can blow that up. And he says, the object of this engine is to execute by machinery all the operations of arithmetic, all the operations of analysis, and print any or all of the calculated results. There is nothing other than mathematics in his conception. This is after 50 years of mature contemplation. So it is Lovelace who made the connection between the world and the machine. And if we return to the forgotten title of this thing, which is Two Visions of Computer, we have Lovelace's vision, which I've described as the ability of the machine to manipulate according to rules, representation of the world contained in symbols. And we have Babbage's conception, which is bounded by mathematics. So we have Lovelace, who sees the potential of the machine with an outreach way beyond the boundaries that Babbage sees and way beyond mathematics. And it's for these ideas that Ada Augusta, Countess of Lovelace, deserves to be celebrated as fully as she is. Thank you.